Colum the Eighth had gotten a hold of a worn rake and was using that to pull some of the stuff closer. He stuck his hand into the boiling air and scooped out hot ashes, which showed that he either cared very little for his own pain or had a supremely good poker face. He held them out for inspection. Whatever had burnt down to a sandy, gray-white stuff that left grease marks on the Eighth's yellowed palms. The necromancer teen was saying listlessly, "I can tell fresh human cremains. Can't you, princess?" Corona hesitated. The second butted in. "What if they were burning bones? One of the servants may have fallen apart."
"Someone could just go ask," rumbled Colum the Eighth,
shocking Gideon with an inherently sensible suggestion. Isaac didn't hear. "That's rendered fat and flesh, not dry bone."
"They didn't... Are the Fifth still..."
"Magnus and Abigail are still where they ought to be," said Jean-Marie fiercely. "In the mortuary. Someone's been killed and burnt up in the incinerator."
There were long scratches down her face. She was even smudgier than her counterpart teen, if that was possible, and in that moment she looked feral. Her curls had frizzed up into a dark brown halo, one liberally streaked with blood and something else disreputable, and her eyes were welling up from the acrid smoke. She did not look like a stable witness to anyone, especially not to Nibirius. He crossed his arms, shivered in the morning sun, and drawled,
"These are ghost stories, doll. You're both cracking up.
Shut it."
"I'm not your doll, dickhead. Princess, tell him. Tell him those are remains."
"Babs, shut your mouth and fix your hair," said Corona. "Don't discount this straight off the bat."
As per usual, he looked wounded and scruffed the towel around his damp hair.
"Who's discounting?" he said.
"I'm not discounting. I'm just saying there's no point. No need for all this fourth house sound and fury.
Anyone goes missing, we assume they're having a nap in the incinerator."
"You are being," said the second cavalier, "surprisingly blasé."
"I hope you end up in the incinerator," said Jean-Marie. "I hope whatever killed Magnus and Abigail and whoever we just found comes after you. I'd love to see your face then.
How will you look when we find you, Prince Nibirius?"
You're listening to Nun Pod with Left Grief, episode 22. Who's dead?
Oh, man. Oh, man. Shit is getting buck wild.
Yeah, we've talked in the last couple of episodes that it feels like there's a real acceleration.
Yeah, and I feel like all of the characters now are, like, feeling that energy, and all of their interactions have that kind of, like, you're seeing their responses to chaos. You're seeing their responses to, like, distressing surprises. You know, the second is being like, we have to take control. The teens are a little bit frantic and, like, very much retreating into each other.
I felt like this chapter was such a turning point in the teens really claiming agency and like they're running the show. Whereas previously we've seen them, you know, being the pages to Magnus and Abigail and just sort of being there, being victims in moments. And here they're like problem solvers. They
totally
have encountered something during presumably some kind of investigation. They were, you know, going around looking at stuff. They found this, they identified what it was. And then they were like, we need adults. Our adults are gone. Who are our next line adults?
Yeah, totally. And the previous chapter ended really on an observation about that shift. And I think for me, I'm seeing them, the emotional intimacy of them processing this in each other's confidence, even in public. But you're right, they are taking up more space and even being observed by the other houses in that initiative, no longer as like through the direction and mentorship of the Fifth, but through their own motivations and their own responses to the situation.
I think we also get some more differentiation between their personalities. We start to see that Isaac is a little more diplomatic. Jean-Marie is a little bit more aggro.
Like, I love this baby. I love Jean-Marie so much.
I mean, they're both precious.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting seeing, like, you know, Jean-Marie is, like, in some ways in this, like, who are the next adults? Like, Magnus and Abigail were our adults in the beginning. And outside of anyone else designating themselves as adults, such as the second who tried to claim that and no one really took to that, Jean-Marie is like, let me nominate the next adults. And it's the people that Magnus liked. And so she's still using the fifth's tendencies as like where she's getting that authority from. But she's basically nominating some kind of authority or leadership within the group to observe things of significance, which I'm curious to see how that'll continue to play down the road.
I think it makes a lot of sense given how Magnus and Gideon interacted that they went for Gideon. But I think Corona is a really interesting choice. And I suspect that they went for Corona because Corona had been the one emphasizing trusting each other and collaborating in this like really recent scene.
So Jean-Marie, you know, was the one there and Isaac came to get them. So this is also kind of an interesting thing where it's like Jean-Marie made the decision on who to get, not the necromancer, which is an interesting kind of reversal of what is normally the power structure between Necro and Cav. Like Jean-Marie is the one staying close to the evidence. Jean-Marie is the one deciding who the adults are. And she's picking people who in some ways were, through her experience with Magnus, the ones that they are most keen on, which means that like Isaac didn't have a strong preference or within their relationship, he's not going to be the one being decisive about that kind of thing.
I think that the Cav practice session is a really critical moment in how they came up with the idea of having adults.
100%, 100%. And it's also still this really interesting thing where it's like Corona was the only necromancer there. Necromancer. Which is still a fantastic little clue about, you know, what's going on for Corona Beth, but does put her in this position of now there's a necromancer and a Cav. They say, okay, these two adults are the ones that we are going to defer to now that we trust because Magnus had this rapport with them. Corona Beth was an adept who reached out and formed relationships with the Cavaliers. And, you know, Isaac's tendency towards more diplomacy than Jean-Marie probably would say, okay, yeah, Corona Beth makes sense in terms of all the different adepts who are here at Kanan House. Corona Beth is the most approachable, the most, as you say, advocating for trust between the houses. And if they're trying to build consensus and build investigation together through the houses, like Corona Beth is the most motivated to help them do that.
Yeah. And I think that their strategy in who they chose, the way it looks to me is they asked for another Cavalier that they felt like they could trust who would make them feel safer in that moment. And they asked for the most approachable necromancer who could verify that these are human remains. And that is the absolute tragedy of this strategy, because instead of having that moment, being able to have an adept say, yes, of course I can feel that these are human remains. She can't do that.
She hesitated. She's like, oh shit. She's not qualified. And she knows that. And now she's on the spot. And she still has to kind of hold up this facade that even though it is clearly falling apart, as it has been in the last couple of chapters, she's not free to relinquish it because it is part of her safety.
But she also can't guess when a murder investigation is on the line. She can't be wrong here.
Yeah. Which is interesting, like when you think of, you know, Mercy Morin's medical knowledge, this is practical knowledge, like the identification of, you know, the burnt remains of bone versus the burnt remains of fat and flesh is something that someone could actually probably look at ashes and develop a familiarity with. So there's probably, I would guess, things that Corona could, like within the necromancer knowledge base, have some kind of familiarity with. But as Colum said, they need a bone magician. They need someone who is more familiar with this than the kind of necromancy that the third would be specialized in.
I think I disagree with you on both the idea that you could, like, in real life, identify ashes as human. I think that without necromantic magic, it's just not going to be distinct enough. But I could be wrong. I am not an expert in human remains. But I think that at the point that it's ashes, certainly I will say things are passed off as human remains that aren't all the time. So at a non-expert level, for sure, easy to pass off. But I think at an expert level also, once it's ashes. And so the only thing that would be giving them that insight would be the necromancy. But
interesting. And I'm also thinking about like the organic chemistry side of it, where it's like, okay, so we have these different types of molecules, but at the end of the day, all of these are organic molecules made up of the same carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, like the and so these, you know, combustion reactions have variations, but what is going to turn into a gas and what is going to turn into a solid is going to be pretty consistent across different organic molecules.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. Is it the point that it's just sort of a carbon byproduct? Like a lot of stuff is going to end up with the same, and particularly like the difference between a human body and another mammal body is going to be really, really slight at that level, if any, on a chemical level.
Yeah, and I guess like, you know, if I'm thinking of impartial incineration, maybe there's some evidence there in terms of like residual fats and the way that that might clump. But if it's an incinerator, it is designed to be extremely high temperature and thorough. So yeah, I think I take that back, and I'm more leaning yours, where it's like we're going to be getting high temperature incineration, which is going to minimize the amount of differentiation between, you know, fats and flesh and bone. And that's not even like getting into the interesting question of like, how dry are the construct's bones? Like how dried out are they?
Yeah. Yeah. And Isaac, who is not a bone specialist, is like really treating this as like, duh, everybody can tell that this isn't that.
Mm-hmm.
But he's mostly talking to Cavaliers. And so they're like, I don't know, like it's all the same to me. And he's like, it's not all the same, Corona, tell him. And she's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be.
And the conversation goes so quickly that you don't necessarily really notice that. It kind of just skips past the question because Colm is like, we could just ask a bone magician. Like we could just, this is not, nobody here is a specialist in these materials. Let's get a specialist. And Gideon's like, oh yeah, I know a specialist in that who is sleeping back at our quarters, which is where we start this chapter. This is the first time that Gideon's like, oh, there's Harrow, and she's staying still and she's quiet and I'm going to go do my own thing. Like, unprecedented. And also the description is very funny. The visual of what's going on there, comparing the way the two of them sleep, is extremely funny to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the stiffness in Harrow's body in this description is just like, how I'm imagining how she, like, did she just like cover herself in everything and then kind of just like immediately pass out in like a T pose?
Yeah, I bouncing back to the little miniature scenes at the beginning of this chapter before Gideon goes off by herself. The bath is adorable.
The bath is adorable. Oh gosh. Gideon as soup.
Gideon takes her very first bath in all of life.
Yeah.
And takes a bath with her face paint on, which is gross. And it's just watching the oil slicks of soap and water soluble paint drift around in this tub, like, hell yeah. And that's precious.
Precious and also kind of nasty. It's funny if you think about, if you're a bath person, like as a cosplayer, I would never have a bath without taking my makeup on off first. Like, ew. Like, I get it. Person soup is gross to, like, baths inherently are gross to some people. But, like, take off your makeup.
Shout out to whatever skeleton servant has to come clean this bathroom later.
But, like, Gideon both recognizes that it's gross and, you know, going into the sonic shower afterwards, but also is very naive about that in a way that only someone who has experience with baths would be like, ew.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
So then after this soporific bath, she has this little fight with Harrow, where Harrow is curled up in bed with the pillows over her head and her arms sticking out. And she's just sort of like tossed her clothing at the laundry. She must be exhausted. And Gideon tries very much to wake her up to have a fight with her, and she's not interested. I love that Harrow's solution to being in this fight is to just slither more deeply under the covers. That is an extremely childlike solution to someone is yelling at me.
Just no, I go further into my burrow. I would love to at some point go through and be like, how many times does Gideon actually call Harrowhark by anything resembling her name or title? Because we're getting real casual now. It's no longer like, you know, my dark lady or some other melodramatic name. It's like just ass munch. Just like there's the casualness here is very like cool. You're very comfortable with each other.
She does also refer to her as Nona Jesimus in this scene.
Oh, yeah, there we go. It's right. It's right there. There's that a certain type of familiarity being like, OK, yeah, you have a name. But like Harrow is too intimate. Harrow is too friendly.
Oh, yeah. We don't do first names. Yeah. That's not how we do it.
That's not how we do it.
You might enjoy the Locktomb Wiki page for Harrowhark has a long list of all of the different nicknames that Gideon has given her.
I would enjoy that. We have a bunch of these little mini scenes before we get into this like much juicier we're at the incinerator scenario. And so we have, you know, Gideon's solo. We have Gideon with Harrow, and then we have Gideon with Isaac, where we, for the first time, we get a really like close up interaction with Isaac.
Yeah, we get a lot of detail about Isaac in this moment. I'm doing multiple rereads of Gideon the Ninth, like at the same time right now, and two of them have now crossed paths. And so I actually read this chapter twice this week, once only for costume clues and once for this episode. And
I think
so,
it's funny
like,
that both of us simultaneously while making this podcast have other reasons that we are doing rereads and other reasons that this repeatedly is happening
true,
for both
yeah.
of us. Yeah.
I forgot that you are also multiply rereading the book.
I'm also multiply reading the book.
But this moment with Isaac tells us so much about him. Because it gives us this, like Harrow, he's wearing embroidered robes. He used to have a whole bunch of earrings, but he has started losing his earrings and not replacing them. So we can see that level of like stress and chaos in just his daily maintenance of himself. He had previously brushed his hair up in this, you know, really contrived style, and now it's just kind of doing whatever it's doing. And so we get this beautiful sort of contrast between what he is supposed to look like, what Gideon is used to him looking like, and how just, I don't know what the word
that
I want
is.
The
comes to mind is deconstructed. Well, in the sense of like the parts of him that made the initial impression are all there, but they're not there in the right shape. They're not there really in the right like assembly. Like I'm thinking of, you know, when you have like a captive ball ring earring and like maybe he's lost some, but there's like some that have also lost the ball in them. And mm-hmm. like, you know, I always imagine him somewhere between like a pompadour and a mohawk. And so when you think of someone who's like had either of those very stylized, very structured hairstyles, and they just kind of slowly fall apart. Like they fall apart very distinctively. So there's all these really fairly high maintenance aesthetic choices that Isaac has as part of his presentation that like each have their own distinct way of kind of deteriorating. And so we have this very specific assembly of deterioration.
Yeah, that the way that he looks when he is falling apart tells you a lot about how he usually is.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this like this tender little like sweet puppy fat, like this is a child who has not yet like gone into his big growth spurt. Like he's mm-hmm. still on the child side of adolescence.
Yeah.
In a way that I'm like, this is a baby.
Yeah.
And I appreciate Muir's pause for that, for recognizing the tragedy of this experience, of the fact that this is a child who has just found these remains. But then there's also, like, when we get into the conversation about the remains, I'm like, oh, well, what about the fourth's necromancy? Like, they're infantry. So, like, mm-hmm. what is Isaac's skills? Which is a very unsettling question to think about. The things that Isaac is good at involves a lot of people dying. It's this weird contrast when you think about the, like, this tender baby and then this, like, oh, this is why he's not able to answer this question confidently, because he has, like, his necromancy is battlefield necromancy, but they are just babies.
Anticipating her absolute tour through canon AUs, we get this swimsuit edition moment.
The pool, like, definitive pool scene number 2 or 3 now. Because, like, this pool goes through a few different iterations and we take a pause to examine it and notice its evolution over time each time we go through this room.
Yeah, so we got stinky weird pool and we had pool actively being cleaned and now we have pool in use. This is a glistening saltwater pool and Coronabeth and Nibirius are in swimsuits, swimming laps, and Gideon is completely verklempt at the notion of a swimming pool and also Coronabeth in a swimsuit. And I noticed on this reading that the way that Coronabeth and Nibirius are dressed to swim is initially framed as very similar, rather than a highly gendered alternative between what he's wearing and what she's wearing. It's initially set up that they are both wearing light singlets and trunks. And then we later get the detail that Nibirius's singlet is much tighter because he wants to show off his muscles.
And with this, we also get another hint about the true nature of Coronabeth. It's interesting that while she is trying to maintain this facade of being a necromancer, there's all of these things where she's just doing cav shit.
She's just doing cav shit.
She's just doing cav shit the whole time.
This is a room full of cavaliers and they are swimming, they're tending to their weapons, they're training, and she's the only, again, the only necromancer in the cav training room doing cav training, dressed like a cav, acting like a cav, being a cav.
Yeah, yeah. I know that when we get to a later scene, when we will deconstruct, you know, what happens to Nibirius through this book, the, like, Coronabeth versus Nibirius as calves dynamic will be something that we spend, I'm sure, a lot of time talking about. But, like, these moments for me are so charged of, like, Yanthi knows that this is what their day-to-day looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And she just doesn't care. Like, she doesn't actually care about maintaining an impression anymore. Because, like, the tells are more and more and more as we go on.
I really appreciate how Tamsin Muir's misdirects function as well, that there are all these clues, but at the same time, you don't wonder what Coronabeth is doing there because she is the main character's love interest. And so she's there because it's hot when the girl is in a bathing suit. Like,
yeah,
that's functionally, narratively, like, you don't wonder why she's there because you're like, she's there because people are in swimsuits and that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just like Coronabeth beach edition.
Yeah. Like, she's like, there so that Gideon can look at her.
Yeah.
But that's actually not why she's there.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, is such a great example of exactly as you say, like, the way that Muir inserts redirects is, like, there is, if you're seeing the writing as very rudimentary and simple, it makes sense. And, like, when I first read these books, I was like, yeah, hot Corona, let's do it. And then as you, like, reread this book and realize more about the way that Muir writes, you're like, ah, oh, I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for hot Corona.
I am such a credulous reader in terms of labeling characters as desirable. Like, when I played Doki Doki Literature Club, I fell for the girls in the exact right order. I was the perfect chump. And I'm not even familiar. That was the first dating sim I had ever played. It was not genre familiarity. I'm just that guy.
Oh, boy. I bet that made any other dating sim you played after that an interesting time.
I don't want to get kidnapped again.
Yeah, fair. I recommend Boyfriend Dungeon as a dating sim. It's a nice time.
That sounds like I'm going to get kidnapped again.
Just like this like long extended scene of just what it's like to see Corona swimming.
Yeah. Upon seeing her golden skin and exceedingly long legs, Gideon made her first and only devout prayer to the locked tomb of thankfulness and joy. I am also that gay.
And I think that Corona is in so many ways like set up as the like both gift and bait for us to be that gay.
And yeah, to be distracted in the way that Gideon is distracted. But taking this scene more seriously for a moment, this is deeply unflattering to our main character.
Yeah.
If we experience this in the context of a silly enemies to lovers sci-fi fantasy story, we're like, yeah, okay, somebody got murdered, and then we're going to think about hot girls for a minute. But if we actually take this moment seriously on its own terms, this is somebody who has been approached by what, a 14, 15 year old in her community who has said, I just found a dead body. Can you help me? And then takes a second to just have a boner. Like, what a gross thing to do in that moment.
And recognizing that, I think, like, recognizing Gideon's shortcomings, I think, slowly gives more of an understanding of why things go throughout the trilogy the direction that they go for Gideon, and why she's totally fine with that. Like, we love our girl, but also she's not a great person. We want to sympathize with her plight because, like, her life is unjust in very meaningful ways, but like it has had an impact on her that she hasn't had a lot of she hasn't had really any positive, like Magnus is a positive interaction that she's had in her life, but outside of that, really quite short, and it's left a mark on who she is and how she interacts with people.
Yeah, I think that there to sort of, I don't know, complicate my own reading here. Responding to mortality with life affirmation, including sexuality, is not that unusual.
Yeah.
I think that it's too soon.
It's too soon. And I think the vulnerability of it being like the childish child in this story at present being the one who is vulnerable in this narrative, like, really, really highlights that. Like, if it was, I don't know, Palamedes coming to get Gideon, it would be a different vibe. But yeah, it's someone who is saying, I need someone I can trust. Jean-Marie has said we can trust you. And Jean-Marie has said we can trust Corona. And Gideon's like, fuck, Corona's hot.
Yeah. I think it would be really hard for me to be interested in how hot Corona is if there was a really scared 14-year-old holding my hand.
Yeah, exactly. There's a real contrast. Like, if it had been, like, Lieutenant Dias, I could totally see Gideon being like, man, this soldier is a real bummer. Thank goodness there's this hot princess.
Yeah, I mean, she also did respond in that same way during the investigation of Magnus and Abigail's death in the immediate aftermath. She was like, ooh, slinky nighties.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that, like, part of this you could say is maybe the like hormonal teenager version of like this instrumentalization of the body, where it's like there's an emotional reality here that is secondary to the like objectification that,
yeah,
is really, really easy for Gideon to just like jump to in any interaction. Like with Dulcinea, that's the first way it kind of starts. It's often this very physical description of when Gideon realizes that someone's there. And I'd be curious to look back on like the different people that she sees when she first recognizes them in a scene.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting contrast here between the sort of desexualizing moment that she has when she thinks about the fact that Dulcinea is going to die on first meeting with sort of this moment where she's like, oh yeah, people just got murdered. Another person just got murdered. Anyway, nice legs.
And like in a way that engages with the ninth, like, which is so strange. Because normally like Gideon doesn't, like, this is like, okay, Gideon's gonna have a positive religious relationship with this very traumatic origin of her life. Like, weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
Gideon is really anti-creep, but she's also a real creep herself.
I would be curious at how Gideon would respond if that mirror was shown directly to her. But I think there would be a lot of what we see in Nona that kind of it would initially come out.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I don't think Kiriona would care at all.
Nah.
Another costume note, since I, you know, was just dissecting this chapter for costumes this week as well. It's weird that the cohort does not have a separate dress uniform and a training uniform. And I wonder if this tells us something about what their dress uniform is made of. And they have just collapsed that distinction because they are using some sort of material and construction where it works for both.
This evokes to me the like the sci-fi trope of the like one purpose fits all onesie,
mm-hmm.
where it's some sort of futuristic material. And it's like covers from ankle to wrist to neck. And it's very both like neutering, but also flattening in terms of like human experience. Because we have so many different garments for different purposes, which is highlighted in different houses, especially the houses that navigate the like the fifth and the third have all these different outfits.
Mm-hmm.
They navigate the social cueing that comes out of costume. But like the soldiers... Interestingly enough, like Isaac has this embroidered garment. So like there's some interesting cues here going on of like what is expected in terms of how you spend your time,
mm-hmm.
and what is important about how you are perceived. Like the perception of the second is pretty flattened. Like they are always soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
There's never any variation. Yeah. They're like, The future space suit, the future space onesie is the thing that really this feels like.
Yeah, definitely with a jacket, because it says that it has a jacket and the jacket has buttons, but mm-hmm. it's got to be a jacket that you can sword fight in. So possibly it is modeled more after a fencing jacket than a sort of military uniform jacket typically. Yeah.
Some of the different like historical Star Trek uniforms have given some of that vibe. And from my understanding, they've been two pieces, but they're supposed to be these very multi-purpose, like they do have a dress uniform for like formal occasions, but otherwise it's a very like utilitarian, but also like they're explorers in a lot of the Star Trek that we see. So they are like active. They're like, we're going straight in the teleporter and going down to ground. We are not changing our outfit. We are just bringing a tricorder and then we're going. Like they're very practical. And so I think of it maybe somewhere along those lines.
It does seem like there are at least two different kinds of uniform that the second wear while they're at Kanan House, because at mm-hmm. one point they are mentioned to have crimson jackets, and in another place they're mentioned to have white jackets. So yeah. There are at least two different kinds of jackets, or there's an error
in terms of like color coding houses. That would make sense, and like color coding occasions. So I think of like sports uniforms.
Yeah, and it does seem like when we see the cohort later in the series, it is mostly white with just sort of an acknowledgement of the house color. So it yeah. seems like maybe the cohort on the second has the red jacket, but generally the white jacket is worn. I don't know.
Yeah. And then I think of, you know, military uniforms that are in white. Like it is not a practical color for most things, like white pants, white jackets. Like that is you bring it out very rarely.
Yeah. The laundry technologies of the house system must be amazing, because we have seen quite a bit of white wool recently.
And there's like, you know, ways that people are trying to develop daily wear whites that are very, you know, resistant to staining. And like, there's all sorts of interesting, you know, the way Scotchgard works is an interesting piece where it's like, okay, this is now hydrophobic, or this material in no way has any porosity to absorb or bind to any pigment. Like, there's all these different ways that we try and do this in the modern era. But at the end of the day, in terms of application, white military uniforms are almost exclusively used in ceremonial and like formal circumstances. There's also this thing of like the laundry on Canaan House. There's an interesting question there that has come up before of like, how many outfits did they pack? What made sense to pack? What could they have assumed about the laundry facilities on Canaan House? Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't included in the invitation, like a pack list.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible, of course, that we simply were not given insight into what would be a pretty boring practical thing that only us and Abigail specifically would be into. But yeah, like, what are the assumptions here? How does this work? Definitely, it seems like Hera owns more clothing than Gideon, which would make sense. Gideon is pretty explicitly only having a few items of clothing total. Others seem to have a lot more. You know, there's a lot of variety in the third. There's a lot less variety in the second. This all kind of makes sense.
Canaan House was built and established thousands of years before this invitation was sent. So has it just been kept up with modern trends around domestic practices? Like, as a matter of course of maintaining it as a facility? Like, that's interesting in its own way. Because, like, the way that we do laundry, the way that we do hygiene, like, is time-stamped.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they have the sonic cleaners, which is at Canaan House, but they also have baths, which maybe is quite anachronistic across the empire. We don't really know, but that is kind of a sign of how things change over time in terms of technology, norms around bodies, norms around hygiene. Like, it's one of those questions where I'm like, did Muir think about this? Is this part of the intentional world building? Or is this the thing that's like, we actually don't have to think about that in detail. It's in the background and sorts itself out. But is like actually a really interesting question to those of us with a very certain historical curiosity. And once again, I mentioned historian Ruth Goodman, who really apparently is quite a pioneer in that field of research.
Yeah. And the fact that the skeletons are clothed, but skeleton servants aren't usually clothed, is also something that kind of adds to this laundry question.
Yeah,
were the skeletons dressed when no one was here? Or have they put clothes on because people were coming over?
Are the skeletons shot? And which then extends to the priests and teacher. Like, mm-hmm. What are their programmed relationships to a sense of body and being perceived in your body and how to maintain it for appropriate perception?
I wish that I could buy teacher a couple of beers and have like a really in-depth conversation about his relationship with gendered embodiment.
That would be a great podcast episode. I'm suddenly thinking of like a podcast series where it's just like in character interviews with different characters, just asking like those questions that you're like, okay, so what about like, and it's all just right. Pure speculation.
So if Electopause hasn't ended by the time we catch up,
that's our next podcast.
So catching up our mini scenes to our major scene here. It is important to remember as we are analyzing the rest of this conversation that the fourth are frazzled, half put together, and now just absolutely smeared with soot and blood and whatever weird stuff they've been up to. The third are wet and in bathing suits. Nibirius is canonically wearing wet socks because he's a monster, whereas Coronabeth is just barefoot. He's got some towels. She's just chilling. So everybody's weird. It's a weird, this is a weird tableau.
And as described as a baffled gaggle, I also want to posit a baffling gaggle. Because to like see this group, you're like, okay, how did this come about?
Also, like, where are all the necromancers? All of the necromancers are just unattended.
I mean, no, one is sleeping.
One is fine. One is fine.
One is fine. theoretically, one is face down somewhere out in the rain waiting for someone to find her body.
One, we have discovered, has been off by herself the whole time anyway.
So we have one. We know where three necromancers are by the end of this chapter.
So no, what is four, what is four. Judith up to? What is Silas up to? We don't know what the sixth are doing during this chapter. That's
right, Palamedes. So, like, Abigail is in a freezer. So we know where four are. And then what Palamedes doing. You know, he's our fucking necro-dating things.
So they are all, they come together to investigate. And I was so glad that you recommended the segment that you did, because one of the things that it highlighted for me was part of the theme of this chapter that really speaks to me is the notion of epistemic justice. This idea that, like, some people are given credibility and some people are not given credibility. And the reasons that we discount people are often shitty. So, like, the description of Jean-Marie as not a stable witness because she looks distressed should offer more support to her claim that she's just found a dead body. That's totally consistent with this is a teenager who has just found a dead body, but it's being used as evidence that she can't be relied on because as a young girl of color, her emotionality, her messiness, her being out of sorts is being treated as evidence that she doesn't know what she's talking about and can't be trusted.
And I think more than anywhere I've seen in the book so far, like, her race is highlighted here more specific in detail than in ways that are so unambiguous that, like, you know, her brown skin as she puts her forehead on Isaac's, the fuzzy halo because her hair is no longer in whatever, like, protective style that she defaults to keeping it in. It's like very clear there is a list of reasons, and that is one of them.
And she's described in animalistic terms. She's described as feral.
Mm-hmm. Which is so interesting if there's, like, okay, there's a contrast. If there's these assumptions on what, like, a reliable witness would be like, we're going to invert it to the other things, which is, like, almost unsettlingly cold.
Well, Corona is assumed to be a reliable witness. So they get Corona. They get Corona to corroborate because Corona will be trusted. And Corona, the person who's given this unjust, excessive credit in this moment, doesn't back her up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leaves her even more epistemically vulnerable than she was before she asked for help.
We know that part of that is because Corona knows that she doesn't have the expertise to do that. It doesn't matter because this is about social perception.
Mm-hmm.
That is why she was chosen to be brought into this situation.
Yeah.
And not only that, you know, other people who are perceived to have more authority and, like, acknowledge that in themselves, like, Nibirius thinks he has authority to comment on this, even though he's a cavalier. That is more to do with social perception than the fact that he just got here. He knows nothing about cremains. Like,
but Nibirius always thinks that he has standing to comment because he's a prince.
He does. He absolutely does. And I think that, you know, is the other side of that epistemic injustice thing of the people who, like, have no credibility, who, like, in terms of actual practical credibility, yet seem to assume that they both have it and are entitled to being having it recognized.
Colum's suggestion that why don't we get the highest, most credible source that we can to resolve this is in one way very reasonable, but according to Isaac, any necromancer should be able to speak authoritatively on this topic. And so it's also kind of setting the goalposts somewhere higher than they need to be in order to exclude Isaac.
Yeah, totally. Looking at also the roles that their houses play in society and the kinds of authority designated and the kinds of priorities in terms of seeking consensus and other authorities to corroborate with. Like, Jean-Marie and Isaac are infantry. There's a very practical kind of seeking of information here that's like, we need the stuff that we can use. We need something that can be very verifiable, hands-on, while Column, like, purity of knowledge is much more part of what he would defer to because of the difference between the houses. Like, despite the fact that, like, the eighth hates the ninth, he would rather defer to someone who he thinks is more deserving of that authority than of someone who is literally there and already has that expertise.
Lieutenant Dias's confidence is also really interesting to me. She is the first one to comment. She's immediately like, no, this isn't human. This isn't anything. And then she's pretty checked out for the rest of the conversation. She's not super involved as this argument is unfolding.
And there's this moment where Jean-Marie like recognizes, it's like, this is not what I wanted, when it's a whole group of people. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of see the dysfunction that she rightfully expects to go down immediately play out in front of her with Lieutenant Dias and Nibirius contributing to the conversation in a way that absolutely destroys it in terms of a fact-finding conversation.
Especially given that this is a group of people who are all calves, so they don't have the expertise needed to actually verify the claim. And several of these people, or maybe all of these people, are from houses that have tried to make claims to authority in the past. And so they all have a stake in being the one who's right rather than finding the right answer.
Which I think like really highlights the fact that Jean-Marie's expectation of like, oh no, they brought other calves. I didn't want these people here. Like, she was right to say, I just want these two people, because she knows, probably from experience, from being a young person from a house that is seen as like child soldiers on the front, the way that her knowledge based on experience is treated.
Yeah, I think this is the strategy that Jean-Marie exhibits here. Although her emotionality is very impulsive and, you know, she's obviously not being very diplomatic here, the actual tactics that she employs and the judgment in not wanting this whole group of people and in choosing a person that she can trust who can help keep her safe and a person who can help corroborate Isaac's judgment was an incredibly smart strategy.
And I circle this back to like the logic of infantry. The training around infantry is extremely practical.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, I know what my desired outcome is. It is safety for myself and my adept, and it is a confirmation of our suspicions.
Yeah.
We are going to have the simplest solution with the most trustworthy people, and we are going to try and get it as directly as possible. Like, she is still thinking in the way that she, I assume, would have been trained to think.
And I think it's so tragic that Corona's lie is ultimately the thing that causes this to go so sideways. Because if they had only asked for Gideon, they would have gotten Gideon and not gotten this whole gaggle of other people who are going to cause issues. It was only going for Corona that brought all these other people in. And it was only the fact that Corona actually doesn't have the standing to make this judgment that caused this huge problem. Because if they were even right about Corona, it wouldn't be that big of a problem. All these other people would say, it's nothing. And Corona would go, it is though. And then Babs would turn and everybody else would follow.
Yeah, which says to me two things. One is Corona is not willing to extend the lie. I think it almost feels like she's only willing to keep it up as the minimum amount necessary. Like, she's not going to, you know, jump to some speculation just to try and expand their perception of her as an adept to kind of, you know, build that authority in some way. So there's a kind of like reluctance to lie that I sense in that. Like, she doesn't want to make a mistake by kind of confirming or denying in this situation. But also, she is an absolute epicenter of this vying for socially perceived authority. Like, the third is the, you know, the house of nobility and navigation of class power and, you know, the propaganda house. Like, she brings along with her this mess of people vying for authority. And she doesn't ever in any scenario like kind of disengage from that. It's really part of every scene that she's in.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think on some level, as we think about, you know, the unwillingness to risk being wrong here and the fact that she was in the Cavalier training room to begin with, and in previous scenes, the fact that she didn't spill her blood, the fact, like, on some level, she's not trying that hard to pass for a necromancer.
Yeah. So it, to me, says that this illusion is something she's doing for Ianthe. It is by Ianthe's design.
My sense is that the main goal of this lie is so that they don't get broken up, so that they can structurally stay together, so that they can receive the same schooling, go on the same trip, etc. And once they are more or less together, she doesn't care.
Absolutely. They can be a lot more casual about it. Corona can't help but play these games. Like, she could disengage further from this. She could have been like, oh, let's get the bone magician. Like, she could advocate for perhaps someone that could actually answer this question in a way that would be perhaps socially plausible, because she seems very savvy that way. But like, she's always trying to navigate this game.
I think even getting it wrong wouldn't be that bad. It seems like it is on first impact. And so like, she doesn't have time to think this through. So she's just stuck. She's just having that moment of running the calculations and then missing the window. But I think, you know, with the convenience, with the luxury of sort of being able to think about it after the fact, if she had said, yes, this is Cremaine's, I agree, and then it turned out that she and Isaac were wrong, they're both wrong. So that doesn't undermine her necromancy, because another necromancer would have also been wrong. And if she had said, no, I don't think this is Cremaine's, and he does, well, we got to get a third person in to really break the tie. Like, that also wouldn't necessarily undermine her status, but it feels like it would have on the surface, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But this whole conversation in this scene happens very fast because everyone's trying to get a word in, and Corona cannot stop to be like, okay, how do I want to play this?
And ultimately just letting it sweep past her is how she's playing it. She is a big person in terms of physicality and personality. If she wanted to get back into that conversation, she could.
Yeah, totally. And there's time, because there's even, you know, some pauses in the conversation before it kind of turns into just Corona and Gideon and Jean-Marie.
Babs leaves. Colm leaves. Marta leaves. And Corona is just still there, staring at the ashes. And she's having what is probably a moment of incredible guilt and self-doubt, that this could be a murdered person, and she, in not really being a necromancer, in lying, has in a small way hindered the investigation. And she knows that, and no one else knows that. And then again, we have Gideon, who's just like, and it was really hot that she was having that moment. Corona staring at the human remains was just real sexy. Gideon, what are you doing?
And you know, Gideon had posited to Harrow that, like, let me out amongst the people. I can kind of get you this information by being around everyone and kind of seeing what they're doing. Like, this is a critical moment for being like, you could dig a little deeper.
And all that's in there is Oreos and pussy.
So Gideon's like checked out, basically, because of said Oreos. But then we get this like really weird, unsettling statement from Isaac.
Yeah.
And because Gideon is really not present, it just kind of fades away.
Yeah. Isaac says, I keep seeing things Out of the corner of my eyes when it's nighttime, I keep waking up and hearing something moving or someone standing outside our door. And Gideon just doesn't react. And so they leave.
Yeah.
He confesses this to the adult that his cavalier thought that they could trust. And she literally does not respond to it. She doesn't say, oh, I'm sure it's fine. She doesn't say, wow, that sounds really scary. She doesn't say, oh, this kid seems like maybe he's totally lost his mind and delusional. And maybe we need to like check in on his well-being. No, she doesn't care.
Yeah. And following that maybe is that like them turning towards each other because they have like taken up this leadership, said we need these grownups to come in and verify this thing that we found. And then these adults completely fucking let them down.
Absolutely.
And I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of like, when you're that young, you don't have the perspective to perhaps say the reason why these adults are not engaging doesn't have to do with me. You take it all into yourself. And it's very heartbreaking because you don't even really register it. It immediately digests and internalizes. And they immediately are say like, you're the only one that trusts me when looking to their house partner. And maybe there's even a moment of self-doubt that kind of comes in being like, oh, well, these grownups don't care. So maybe it's not actually a thing. This is such a powerful age for people claiming agency outside of books. But this kind of treatment from adults is, as you say, really common in terms of like, undermining the agency and like clarity of perception that people have at this age.
It is tragically difficult for children to get adults to believe them about a really bad thing that's happening. And we talk a lot about the desire to protect children from horrific things. But one of the major barriers to actually doing that is that adults do not believe children.
Yeah, I've had a situation, interestingly, recently. So I work with very small children who are honestly like before the age of knowing the difference between dreams and living, between anxieties and worry and lived experience. And so I think there is a very early on dismissal of their voice, of confidence in the authority and clarity of their voice. But there is still something very real within it that needs to be recognized, but so early on that is eroded. And then that's just continued on, like either the minimizing of their emotional experience, the, you know, the questioning or dismissing of their like perspective on like how they've seen a situation that I think in some ways, like you don't reclaim that. It's hard to heal from that and trust your own voice until some point into adulthood when you're like, oh, wait, I'm not like you're like, oh, I don't have to gaslight myself because these children are being like actively told that their perception is wrong or meaningless, which you're like, oh, the adult is doing that. So I'm going to defer to the way that they're handling my perception and doubt myself. Like, that's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, especially in the context of it having only been a couple of days since another murder.
Yeah. And it speaks to the fact that when we dismiss this whole group, like, I want to say like people 20 and under, like a whole group of perspectives, so much insight is lost.
I would say at least 25 because, you know, their prefrontal cortex isn't done, which isn't how that works. But I hear all the time, you know, people in their early 20s, particularly women in their early 20s, particularly women of color, you know, like, and I think it's so meaningful that it is Jean-Marie who is the center of this doubt, even though it's Isaac making the claim.
Like, if you think of a lot of these things as like, not accidental, but by design, It means that there's this real delay in terms of reflecting on the consequences of the choices of the adults around.
Yeah.
Because the actual consequences, there's a whole 25 years of group of people who are experiencing them who haven't been as coached into the lies that are necessary to keep that system. Young people are so much better at saying, what the fuck? They're so much better because they haven't internalized it as much.
Yeah.
All of that time spent, you know, dismissing them and gaslighting them is so that the authority of the adults is maintained and not questioned at all. Like in my city, there was recently a motion to lower voting age to 16, which I am like super in favor of, for simply for the fact that like these people are experiencing the world too. Why don't they get to weigh in on decisions that affect them in a very real and long term and immediate way? But it is very effective at keeping structures of power the same, at taking like, you know, what is maybe a third of a human life and saying we're not going to listen to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I think the minimum voting age should be, if any, but I definitely support programs to try to lower it to 16 or 14. I think the notion that young enough to work is young enough to vote concerns me because of its implications for people who are too disabled to work. But I think young people have a real stake in governance and should have a voice.
Yeah, absolutely. Both for the fact that like a huge amount of governance is evaluating what should and shouldn't be in education, how education is run and funded. Like this is how we structure their lives for 15 or more years of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they have no say in that. Like, and so few people seem to see how fucked up that is.
Yeah, but if you let kids vote, they'll really, really strongly emphasize long-term environmentalism, Claire. You can't, that'll make the money sad.
It'll make the money sad. One of my favorite ways of nourishing and like prompting and seeding like revolutionary imagination for me is when I come across a situation that causes a child suffering. And I'm like, what environment would be necessary for this suffering to simply be absent, to be irrelevant, to not have occurred? Mm. And even people in my immediate life who are, I would think, fairly compassionate towards children's experiences are still kind of threatened by that perspective. I was like, what if we changed what we're doing as adults so that they don't have these experiences that are obviously distressing?
So Claire, a 14-year-old comes to you having found what they believe is a cremated human body. What do you do?
I would immediately try and identify if there's any threats to that child's safety. Because if there's a cremated human body, that probably means that there's an adult who has a secret to protect. And that adult now would perhaps have their sights on that child. Oh boy, I just made myself sad. That voice, if believed, is profoundly game-changing. It upsets the structure of power in that situation in a way that is not reversible.
I think the biggest priority for me in that moment is relieving that child of a sense of responsibility over the situation.
Yeah.
I think for me, it would be taking charge of the scene in a way that that child understood that the scene was being handled, that the problem was being taken seriously, and that they did not have to be in charge of it. So I would delegate one person to be in charge of find the right people to investigate this, and another person to be in charge of tend to the emotional well-being and physical safety of the kids.
As you're describing that, it makes me think of a lot of the like social triage training that comes in more advanced first aid courses of like in where I live, there are laws around how this works, around who is responsible for an emergency scene and how that authority is transferred and delegated. That is built into our first aid training. And it's not often talked about how one might respond if it was a child bringing that information or being the first one on the scene is often the language that you see. Their authority is never even mentioned usually because a lot of the scenarios presented in these trainings are only involving adults.
Maybe it should be, because I've been in situations, I can think of a number of times where a dangerous situation was brought to my attention by a child I didn't know. Sometimes it is a child, and maybe we should be talking about what happens when it's a child. Children are just part of the community, and when things happen in the community, it happens to children.
Yeah, and I've thought adjacent to this a number of times in terms of, like, there's a bunch of things that we don't engage with the way that they'd affect children in explicit terms, unless it is an organization that has specialized in just that, and then only they are deferred to in terms of that conversation. And that's usually not at the, like, government level. Mm-hmm. That's usually, like, a small organization that has specialized in that kind of care or education or whatever. And I think part of this is the inconsistency in recognizing agency and, like, self-awareness and authority between different adults of children. It seems to be an incredibly touchy, controversial thing that ends up just being that children are, like, an objectified class to be used to leverage a conversation rather than a group of people to be engaged with as individuals who have things to say about the way they're affected.
Yeah. Making children safe and welcome in my community is a really big priority. And for me, a big turning point was, gosh, about 10 years ago now, reading Don't Leave Your Friends Behind. And I'll link to that in the episode description, but it's a really valuable analysis of parenting and how leftist political spaces treat children and their caregivers.
And it is probably my most recommended book. You recommended it to me. I love my copy. And, like, I don't think I've, by an order of magnitude, my most recommended book across the board to anyone.
I like it a lot. It really challenged how I was thinking. And I am very grateful to the person who recommended that to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as everyone else leaves, Corona and Gideon are left behind. And now that they're alone, now that the stakes are lowered, Corona confesses to Gideon that this is a real problem. Having failed to stick up for the fourth when everybody could tell, she's now not quite saying, yes, these are human remains, but she's saying, like, hey, maybe we should actually take this really seriously.
Now that it's someone who doesn't talk, who can't perhaps undermine her illusion, she can kind of voice this less confident opinion of hers that she wouldn't take a chance on earlier. But then we have this counterpoint, just like Gideon checks out about Corona's legs, Corona checks out about Gideon's hair.
Yep.
Just again, like, these adults are not reliable.
And then after that, we get this last little scene where it turns out that Protesilaus is missing and Dulcinea has been left collapsed in the rain. So they discover her blue and wet and near death and collapsed, and Protesilaus is missing, which gives us this implication that Protesilaus is perhaps the body in the incinerator.
So we have the first layer of this, like, 1-2 in this chapter. So the first, I have the whole situation that led to the incinerator thing, and then we have this second beat where it's kind of being like, oh, maybe this is what happened. Maybe it's Protesilaus. But knowing what we know now, and you know, building off the conversations that we've really heavily had around who gets to have recognition of authority, who gets to have recognition of truth and reliability, and how this is a play around power, there's now this larger picture of, like, okay, so now we have the pawns, and now we have the puppet master. Very simple little scene. Like, you know, this conversation is happening by the incinerator, and I'm just imagining Kithareia being like, God, can those guys fucking hurry it up? She's lying there waiting for someone to find her.
Yeah.
Every part of this is something that she set up. The whole first half is everyone kind of being like, whoa, what's happening? And then, you know, this the second part is her getting the like final note of this particular design to further reinforce that she's not, couldn't possibly be the threat. She's now been personally victimized by whatever evil thing is taking people out.
Yeah, and we've talked before about how Kithareya is both actually disabled and performing disability.
Mm-hmm.
But having done up to chapter 22, second reread for costumes, I noticed that the performance of disability takes on a seriousness when the fifth are killed. She is not described as having crutches until she has to go into the facility for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is only after people start being killed that she is really playing up the visibility of her disability. She's really emphasizing how weak she is, how delicate she is, how she can't even do the puzzles in the facility because she just physically can't do it. And now when this body is in the incinerator, she arranges for herself to be discovered in this life-threateningly vulnerable moment where her crutches have been splayed aside and she's soaked and she's blue. And of course, Kithareya cannot die of exposure. That is not physically possible. So she could be out there for 3 days if she needed to.
But she does suffer.
She does suffer.
She does truly suffer in the way that someone who would die of exposure would suffer during that process. Like it's so interesting to me. Like she, one of the motivations behind her reasoning for this whole thing is the injustice that she experiences at having to suffer this for thousands and thousands of years of being like dying at the edge of death infinitely. Mm-hmm. And you know, the earlier chapters like talk about Gideon at the edge of death in great length and in great detail, and so you know we don't have that kind of detail about what Kithareya is experiencing out here in the rain, but most certainly she is.
Yeah,
like her body is out here trying to die and she's waiting because it's part of her plan, but like she is suffering more.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's absolutely worth noting that she is hypothermic. She just can't die from it.
In previous reads, I never really spent time lingering on this idea, and I didn't have the multi-death theory in part of my understanding of the book. But like the amount that it asks you to sit and imagine what the experience of not being able to die might feel like is really changes the way the book feels as you read it.
Mm-hmm. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.